News. This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For almost a decade, DC's own The Business of Government Hour has brought you leading government executives who are changing the way government does business. Each week, our guests join us for an informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation about their careers, their agency accomplishments, as well as their vision of government in the 21st century. Over the last 5 years, we've interviewed more than 250 government executives, from department secretaries to C-suite executives. It is from this rich library that we've culled together their insights on topics important to you. This week, Leaders Speak brings you past and current government leaders and their advice on leadership and public service. What makes an effective leader? Why pursue a career in public service? Today, our guests offer their extended reflections on such questions. From overseeing federal programs and operations, ensuring accountability to the American people, to protecting the nation's food supply, and leading the federal emergency management activities, our first conversation focuses on leadership with such leading lights as Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States, Kathleen Merrigan, USDA Deputy Secretary, and FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate.
The Comptroller General and I provide strategic direction and leadership for the GAO. As its chief executive, it's my job to make sure we carry out our mission effectively, which is to support the Congress in carrying out its constitutional responsibilities and to help improve the performance and ensure the accountability of the federal government for the benefit of the American people. And we do that through the production of hundreds of reports and testimonies each year to the Congress that are made also available to the public. And it's very important that we have good quality assurance systems around those reports. So my job is to ensure that that happens and that we have the skilled workforce necessary to carry out these responsibilities. So I also provide testimony to the Congress before various congressional committees, particularly on GAO's, you know, more important broad-based work that we issue during the year. The Comptroller General also sets government auditing standards and internal control standards for the federal government. And also, I have very important representational responsibilities, both for domestic accountability purposes, such as chairman of the National Intergovernmental Audit Forum, and also internationally as the U.S. representative to the Organization Internationally of National Audit Offices, which is comprised of about 189 countries around the world. We're using partnerships in a number of areas. This is very important to make sure we have the broadest perspectives possible and are leveraging our resources through the use of those partnerships. For example, we work very closely with the inspectors general throughout the government on the regular annual audits of financial statements in departments and agencies. They do many of these audits or arrange for them to be done by CPA firms, but we've worked out a joint methodology that's used so that we can use the results of that work in order to help us in determining our audit opinion on the consolidated financial statements of the federal government. We have a similar methodology with the IGs we've worked out in looking at computer security issues across federal government. Our partnerships with the IGs are very important, and we do that consistently. Also have partnerships with the state and local audit community. We work with them very closely in a number of areas. We're contemplating doing some increased work in infrastructure issues, for example, that many of them feel are important at their level. We work, as I mentioned earlier, with OMB in looking at the high-risk areas, and that's a very important partnership. When both GAO and OMB are working on these issues together with the agencies, you can create and a lot more synergies to bring about positive changes in the government. I also work on partnerships with my counterparts around the world, heads of national audit offices in other countries. For example, I'm leading a task force on the global financial crisis, and we have 25 countries involved, including China, many of the countries in Europe, and other areas, to look at past crises, what has led to the current situation, what needs to be done going forward, what role can the National Audit Office play in ensuring the prevention of any future crisis that might occur later. I've also been working with the international community as heading up the international organization, National Audit Office's coordination with donor communities. And we've established a partnership. There are about 16 donors around the world that have signed this agreement with us. The purpose is to strengthen the capacity of national audit offices in developing countries, areas where a lot of foreign aid goes in there, but there's not always the strongest accountability mechanisms to ensuring that the aid goes to poverty reduction and to improving economic and social conditions in these countries. So we have the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, European Union, United States, AID has signed on to this agreement, along with a lot of the regional banks around the world, including the Islamic Development Bank, the African Development Bank, etc. So those are just some sampling of the partnerships. We also use a lot of advisory groups and to help us in GAO identify issues that are important. Well, you have to be able to motivate your organization. I mean, the motivation at the GAO is facilitated because we do such interesting work for the Congress. But it's very important for our organization to be viewed as independent, nonpartisan, professional, objective, fact-based, and providing, you know, a full range of professional services to the Congress that are respected by both parties, by both chambers of Congress. And so being able to have important credibility to be able to lead the organization with integrity and to make sure our work is professional, but also constructive. And it's very important that we not only identify problems but bring solutions to those problems to help policymakers and leaders in the executive branch as well as Congress to take the necessary actions to improve government for the benefit of the public.
As Dodaro outlines, leadership rests on the cornerstones of integrity and professionalism. Following this perspective, here's Kathleen Merrigan, USDA Deputy Secretary, on leadership.
What are the real challenges of leadership? What makes a good leader? Well, that's a big question. There's certainly libraries full of books that give you all the answers, right? For me, it's really trying to empower people around you, around me, to speak truth to power. I think that when you get up at these high ozone level type of jobs, people are very hesitant to say, Kathleen, you're wrong, or Kathleen, there's another way to look at this. And so how do you engender a culture around you that people feel very comfortable bringing issues that are important and that may not sit well with you on first view? So I think that's really important leadership, a skill that I've really worked on and hopefully have succeeded in. I also think it's very important to empower people at various levels in the bureaucracy. We have this task force now we call Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. And it's not all the people with the big name jobs at USDA. I basically said to agency administrators, I want the people who want to be there. Mm-hmm. I don't care what their rank is, what their background is. I want enthusiasm. I want people who are ready to add this to their current workload, not as a burden, but as a joy. And really, it's been a lot of fun.
In the last decade, whether as a result of natural or man-made disasters, the nation's emergency response apparatus has faced enormous challenges. Overcoming these challenges and forging a national emergency response network for the 21st century requires leadership, innovation, and teamwork. Craig Fugate, FEMA administrator, outlines the proper leadership approach in emergency response.
under our system of response to disasters. Local governments respond at the event that they need additional resources. They go to their states, and states coordinate those responses. And if it's warranted, governors may then request to the president federal assistance and on behalf of the president and the Secretary of Homeland Security. FEMA is the agency that coordinates that federal response to those disasters. And emergency managers, by and large, we represent the elected leadership. And we are charged, by and large, to coordinate all the aspects of that political leadership's team. The things that I find are most useful is, one, recognizing that to bring about a true team, you have to be less of a person who takes charge as much as a person who builds trust and confidence and builds collaboration upon many organizations that oftentimes on a day-to-day basis may have competing interests, but in a disaster must work well as a team. It means you have to give up a certain amount of direction and control and spend more time clearly articulating what the mission and goals of the team are, but empowering your team to carry those goals out. And it goes back to the concept of disasters by their very nature. The larger they are, the more people try to gain total control and have this ability to say, we know everything that's going on, the less likely they'll be successful because instead of changing outcomes, they're still spending a lot of time gathering information and trying to figure out what's going on. So I find that the skills that have been most valuable to me is being able to let go of control and give it to the team and create the environment for the team to be successful and to operate in a manner which is safe for them, but at the same time maintaining the accountability to the political leadership on the outcomes we're trying to change. It's a different framework than what I was brought up with in emergency services. The more I try to control it, short-term results were actually better. But in the bigger, more complex disasters, the worse the outcomes became because we were now wrapped around process. And I found that it was often better to identify who's really smart, who's really got the capabilities, really who's got the inherent authorities to deal with this, and let them deal with that and have the rest of the team support them.
As much as leaders lead, effective leaders must also support their teams, cultivating collaboration as the path forward. This is most critical in leading local agencies that deliver critical human services. Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor of New York City's Health and Human Services, recognizes leadership as connecting and collaborating.
You know, I really believe in collaboration. I feel like I make the best decisions when I have as many different points of view around the table as possible and consider a lot of different opinions. You get more knowledge and smarter decisions, but you also get the buy-in of the people that you need in order to make the change happen. Because for me, particularly when you're overseeing operations of critically important services, it's not just about having good ideas. It's about the ability to actually implement them, get them off the ground and make them run and make them run effectively and efficiently. Half of the task is getting the best ideas and the other half is effectively implementing. And so to me, a collaborative process that brings as many people to the table is sort of the critical leadership that's necessary in order to make that happen. So how do we make sure that these collaboration supports are hardwired enough that they don't fall apart? Mm-hmm. Ensuring that we are really instilling in our agencies an obligation to be self-reflective and curious and innovative and to create room and give permission for risk-taking is really important.
In the end, leaders must find good people and put their trust in them. Robert Doerr, Commissioner of New York City's Human Resources Administration, elaborates.
I think it's important to find good people. And once you've got good people working for you, to trust them and rely on them and to support them. I really strongly believe in that. So I'm very dependent on the people that run the various programs in my agency. I'm very much a believer in listening to the agency or the bureaucracy. What are they seeing? What do they know? How would they advise me? And then acting on it. And I think that's important. You have to be a good listener. You also have to be a good communicator. I think that a lot of leaders suffer from excessive secrecy and excessive keeping things close. I am definitely not that. I think the concern about me is maybe I talk too much. But I believe in communicating down to people below, who work below me, making sure they know what I'm about and what we're trying to accomplish. Laterally to my colleagues, which is really important. I think the hardest form of communication because you just don't know where you stand with your various commissioners. And then, of course, like any good executive, I know how to keep the boss informed. So that, I think, is really essential.
From administrating programs to providing mission support, leaders must find a way to choreograph many parts towards an ultimate end. Here's Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, on why he took this role at DHS and his leadership approach.
The reason I'm the CIO here and accepted the position is because I believe IT is a foundational and critical element to the success of an organization such as Homeland Security. In fact, I would say that it is as important as any function in assuring mission effectiveness today. I always try to take a view that I'm only going to be as successful as those that are under me. I can certainly focus on that leadership of the direct reports right under me. So I constantly ask myself, am I doing the things that can put them in a position to be successful? Because if I can make that happen, then I will be successful in the role I'm in. People call that servant leadership, and I like that term. I'm not always having to be the guy out front, although I am many times, like here, being the spokesperson for the department on IT issues. But I really try to take that view. How do I help? And in this case, it even also extends to the CIOs and the components, right? How do I position them for them to grow, to be successful in their roles with that same philosophy? So that's a sense of why. There's been a number of individuals that I have worked under that have really, I think, helped influence me. And it might be trite to say, but you start with your parents. I mean, they were great role models for me in how to be a man of integrity, a person of integrity, a person that can be counted on, can be trusted, is so, so important to me. That being said, when I got into the work world, there certainly are a number of individuals, but I might highlight Ted Legacy as a gentleman that I worked with for years, worked under him for years at SRA International. And when you work with someone for 10-plus years in that kind of role and you admire his leadership style and the way he handled things, those kinds of things rub off. So that's one example, a great example for me of a real leader.
In an era of fiscal constraint, leaders must make tough decisions. One way is to focus on improving operations and becoming more agile, responsive, and efficient. Beth McGrath, Deputy Chief Management Officer at the U.S. Department of Defense, outlines her approach to leadership.
You know, there's a long list of attributes, and having the ability to actually make a decision, to be decisive, I think is very important, to be orderly and purposeful about the direction you're giving, because I think people look for someone to make those decisions. And I also think you need to be confident, but not overly so. So I believe confidence inspires confidence in others, and I believe that, you know, a winning team is a winning team not by accident, because they believe in themselves and they believe in what they do. And so it's really that also ties to the passion. For me now, you know, it's the whole business transformation. What are we doing? It is a passion. I cannot hide it. It is there. But it's also to have the analytical ability to take a big problem in a big enterprise like defense and then break it down into manageable chunks so it doesn't seem overwhelming. So then you can, you know, put together a strategy. And then it lowers the anxiety level for others, because sometimes things are so big and complex, you really need that ability to break something down and be analytical. My last two would be very much a commitment to excellence, not only in the mission, in the work part, but in the people part, the you part. Finally, people need to trust you. You need to be trustworthy. You need to have a strong sense of character.
Bob Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller, understands that an effective leader is one who first can articulate a vision.
I think an effective leader is one who first can articulate a vision of where he wants his or her organization to go. And the vision thing is important and not easy to do. I remember somebody saying to me once, if you don't have a vision and a list of associated tasks that are significantly more than you can do, then you're not stretching yourself. So I think establishing a vision is key, but it's not good enough to just say where you want to go. You need to provide the resources, both in terms of people and dollars, to work to accomplish that vision. and provide the motivation to those who will make that vision a reality for you. And finally, I think an effective leader is one who has a sense of how to measure progress and not do it in a way that's stifling to people who work for him or for her, but also measures how well you're doing so you can make changes as you almost have to do in approaches to achieving your vision.
The head of DOD's Lean Six Sigma program office and retired U.S. Army Colonel J.D. Cecilia reflects on how his military experience has shaped how he leads.
I think the one that they stress in the military and one that stays with you even after you retire is you always have to lead by an example. Lead by example. As an officer in the military, you always seek to attain the highest qualifications that you can in your profession so that you can better lead others. That's what leads officers to go to airborne school, ranger school, those type of leadership development schools. When I got into Lean Six Sigma, I understood that, you know, to lead a group, I would have to be an expert in my field. And so that's why I pursued certification at the Master Black Belt level. And I believe that that has paid huge dividends in understanding what it is that we're trying to lead and the methodology behind it. So lead by example, I think, is the number one lesson I learned that I've carried on through the civilian career. The next one I believe that remains true is volunteer for the hard jobs. There's usually not a line forming for that. And so even though they will be hard to accomplish, there's a greater sense of satisfaction when you complete them. The next one I believe is very important is choose your team wisely. I've had the great opportunity to form three different teams since I've become a civilian, the great privilege to stand up three different organizations, and with that came the opportunity to hire people. And the lesson I take with that is you can tell within about 10 minutes conversation or an interview what the person is really like. And there are certain characteristics that make a great Lean Six Sigma practitioner, and you can't teach those. Another one is that failure is not an option. It's one of those, you know, we're going to succeed, and we're just going to keep working until we do. And the last one, we have a common goal, and that is the success of the warfighter. Whether you're in uniform or out of uniform, I mean, we have the common objective of creating the best support system we can so that those on the front lines get what they need, they get it in a timely fashion, they get it every time the right way.
Our conversation on leadership continues when Leaders Speak, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, returns. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. Government leaders must use the instruments of national power to provide present-day security while setting the conditions for a secure future. Leaders are responsible for envisioning, shaping, and safeguarding the future, creating clarity amidst uncertainty. And this is no small feat. It is made increasingly more difficult in the 21st century, where rapid, unforeseen change seems to be the only constant. How does a leader think about the relationship between power and security? I had the pleasure of exploring this question with two leading thinkers, Professor Joseph Nye and retired General Anthony Zinni. Both bring a rare combination of practical and reflective erudition on the critical importance of leadership today.
Yeah, I think we have a leadership crisis, and it's not just when I did began my last book, I researched to begin with what people feel about leadership. I was shocked to find that somewhere around 75% to 80% of American people think we have a crisis in leadership across the board in every element of our society, and it's not just the United States. Globally, we feel that way. I think that the conditions in the 21st century lead to that. It's a much more complex and complicated world. And so to be competent, you truly have to master not just a narrow field of capabilities, but a very broad field of capabilities. Our leaders are under much greater scrutiny than they ever have ever been before. Their world has been expanded and a spotlight thrown on it. The media, the public, the information, the knowledge is there. So you can't even make a move or a decision that isn't going to be open to criticism. And in many ways, that's good, obviously. In many ways, that really makes it difficult in terms of how leaders have to act. So the stresses, the changes, the degree to which you have to be far more competent in so many different areas, understanding the speed that you have to operate in today and the environment that requires quick decisions, mastering information technology that has overwhelmed us and made the world much smaller and tighter and well-informed, all have impacted on leadership. And so there's a different kind of leader that has to come out now. And I think the old ways of leading won't be effective in this modern world.
General Tony Zinni, author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom, sets the stage, diagnosing the apparent global leadership deficit and how the old ways of leading won't be effective in today's world.
Yeah, and again, I kind of looked at leaders that were making it today, especially in fields that maybe most of the field was not successful. And I found that first of all, they understood the people they lead. Even though the diversity has grown, they manage to be able to touch every one of them. They listen well. They're approachable. But they're able to operate with a greater ability to touch all the people they're with. They understand themselves better. They're much more self-aware. They seek improvement. They seek coaching and mentoring. The successful leaders, they don't assume they get it. They're constantly learning. It's a thinking environment they create. They're critical thinkers. They're systems thinkers. They're creative thinkers. They make decisions based on analysis. They recognize patterns. It's recognitional decision makers. They become more instinctive based on their ability to analyze their experiences and educate themselves. They have a tremendous set of values. They understand the importance of ethics and moral behavior. And because of the scrutiny they're under, I think value-based institutions and leadership now are more successful. There's more demand for it now. They're strategic thinkers. They're visionaries. They look out beyond just the immediate future, the next quarter in business or the next year or two.
So what characteristics are essential for today's leaders? General Zinni continues.
They're effective communicators. Both internally and externally, they can represent the organization. They can articulate who they are, what they are, what they want. And they work well in crisis and change. They can lead through crisis and they can lead through change. It's basically the effects are the same. And recognize the fact that in this very difficult, complex set of times, that in this day and age, every organization will go through significant crisis or change.
Leading through a crisis means having contextual intelligence. Professor Joseph Nye emphasizes the role it plays in the success of any leader.
Contextual intelligence is the ability of a leader to understand the context of power, to realize that power is not the same in all contexts. And this is something which is important to foreign policy, but it's actually important to everyday life. Many a business leader who's very successful in the hierarchy of a corporation comes to government and learns that politics in a fishbowl is very different. And similarly, many a government leader who may come to a university to be an administrator and used to be able to give orders in a university, in a government, doesn't realize that the power structure of a university is very, very flat. So understanding different contexts of power is crucial to developing successful strategies. In foreign policy, It means understanding which of the instruments of power you have, hard and soft, will be effective in which situations. And I'll take you back to that example I gave of Obama and Libya. One can agree or disagree about whether you should be involved in a humanitarian intervention in Libya. But if you're going to do it, then the thinking through what is that particular context, why is it important for me to have an Arab League resolution and a UN resolution, and waiting to use your hard power until you had that, and then to using your hard power in judicious proportions, that's an example of contextual intelligence.
Professor Nye, author of Bound to Lead, assesses the state of global leadership.
Well, we always tend to think in our current era that there were giants in the past and that our leaders today are not up to the task. I don't think that one could make lots of complaints about the quality of leaders today, but if one takes a longer historical perspective, one can see that there were some pretty poor leaders in the past. So I don't think there's a linear trend upward or downward.
Great leaders see opportunities where others see challenges or problems, explains Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DOD.
Change happened, get used to it. Exactly. Is that right? Yeah. You know, it is one of my favorite subjects because it smacks on human nature and psychology and all sorts of interesting disciplines. It really is at the heart of everything that we do. There's lots of great leadership books about this. One of my favorites is Max DePree's book, Leadership is an Art. And it's just fascinating. He has this great quote about great leaders see opportunities where others see challenges or problems. And that really is the key. Are you going to be a cynical voice for change or a positive voice for change? I think people fail to recognize that if you're an IT professional, whether you're in government or industry, you are viewed by all of your peers as knowing more about this subject. And so your level of cynicism, your level of reticence, your level of reluctance or fear becomes like a magnifier for them. It's a resonator. It's like the ripples in the pond, right? A little bit of perturbation on your part creates great angst in the rest of the workforce. It's not to say that you want to, endorse things that are bad ideas. But to the extent that things are a good idea, you have to be an avid vocal storyteller about why they're a good idea. It's no surprise that, if you drew a bell curve of an organization, the majority of people are not like early adopters of change. They're change neutral or change averse. And so if you want to get an organization to move from where it is to where it will be, you have to help the organization have courage and be willing to understand the new idea. We often underestimate the power and importance of storytelling. You can't do it alone, right? Everybody has to be a good storyteller. Everybody has to work together as a team. There's another great book that I love. Forgive me. I have lots of books that I love. But another great one is the book Execution by Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan. And in it, they have a fabulous quote that says, leaders get the behaviors that they exhibit and tolerate. And it is so true. If you're going to be a positive force for change, if you're going to be a leader of teams that are empowered to do great things, wonderful things will happen. If you're not, then you'll fret and fear and things won't get done. Leaders help others find their gifts and find their talents and help create a better future. If you empower smart people to get the job done, amazing things will happen. If you feed their creativity and don't be an impediment in their way, but support them as they go, fabulous results will happen.
Leaders also understand that fabulous results will happen if they take risks. Dr. Bobby Braun, former chief technologist at NASA, recognized this once he took the reins of its science and technology portfolio. For some 18 months, he sought to cultivate a risk-tolerant environment that fosters innovation.
Yeah, well, that is incredibly important to what we're doing. What does acceptable risk mean to a technology development program? And this is part of the cultural challenge that I think that I have and that we're working on. The way I view it is we need to have more of a tiered risk acceptance approach to NASA. If we don't take risk in our technology development program, well, we certainly won't be developing game changers. The only way I know to innovate is to take risk. The only way I know to make progress towards a grand challenge or to develop a disruptive or game-changing technology is to take some risk. And with risk comes a higher probability of failure. What's important is that when we fail forward. We learn from that experience.
Effective leaders must be reflective, learning from experience, but also integrating that knowledge and honing that understanding. Dr. Bobby Braun continues.
So I think to be a good leader today, what it's really all about is integrating. It's about taking knowledge from something you're doing over here on the right and learning something from that and applying it to a new problem, maybe over here on the left. It's about integrating knowledge from disparate fields and bringing that together in innovative ways.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, recognizes that the art of persuasion and being faithful to one's principles are critical to being an effective leader.
Well, I think they're critical, the art of persuasion as well as sticking to your principles. A leader must lead by example. You have to understand the subject and the terrain in which you're trying to lead, and you have to show that you are doing the leading and you're a part of the process as opposed to telling people what to do. You've got to get them to feel that they have an investment in it. You've got to persuade them that this is something that's important, that's exciting, and they're doing it not because you're pushing them to do it, because they really do want to do it. And I think that's the secret of a leader in the arena of persuading somebody to get very, very much involved.
Ambassador Patrick Kennedy, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of State, explains what his long and varied career has taught him about leadership.
Well, I joined the Foreign Service 35 years ago, shortly after graduating from college. I spent my first two tours in the Foreign Service in the Bureau of African Affairs. Came back to Washington after that to become the personnel officer for the Bureau of African Affairs, and went on from there to be a special assistant to the Undersecretary for Management. Went to Paris then as the General Services Officer in that State Department lingo for the Logistics and Maintenance Officer. Came back to Washington, spent 5 years as the Executive Director of the Secretariat, went on to Cairo, which was and still is one of the largest U.S. embassies in the world, was Chief of Administration there, came back to Washington, was Assistant Secretary of State for Administration for a number of years, went to New York. I was one of the deputies to John Negroponte when he was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And during my time in New York, I was twice detailed to Iraq, the first in 2003 for about 6.5 months. And I was the chief of staff for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, then went back in 2004 to do the transition from a Department of Defense-run CPA to the new American Embassy. At the end of my 4-year tenure in New York, I went to Office of National Intelligence and again worked for John Negroponte and helped him set up the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And then in 2007 came back to the State Department. That sort of long and varied career, I think, has taught me a couple of things. The first is the importance of people. You get things done if you have a good team. But I think what I've learned is people will respond to a mission. They'll respond to tough and difficult assignments if you sit them down and explain, this is our goal. This is why that goal is so important. This is your individual mission in supporting that goal. This is how you fit into the big picture. Give them that assignment and then let them do their job. Second thing I learned, that operations overseas are different than they are in Washington. It's not that it's better, it's just different. And having served overseas, it gives you the context as you're now trying to manage something in Washington in support of the field. You have to keep always in mind that things are different. The third thing, I guess, is that there are always problems that arise. You have to be creative and flexible. Events happen overseas, some good, some bad, but you have to be always prepared to surge resources, to operate almost instantaneously, to either protect the lives of American citizens, to working to protect American embassies when they come under attack.
When we return to Leaders Speak, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, we will focus on public service and offer some compelling insights from some of our most thoughtful guests.
What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. The task of growing leaders may be as important a task as can be found today in public service, one which will determine whether government programs will be run efficiently and produce the performance and results citizens expect and deserve. The critical need to grow the next generation of public servant leaders is a central responsibility of leaders themselves. Leaders beget leaders. It's about inspiring the next generation to serve and transform the way government works. Here's Chris Mim, Managing Director of the Strategic Issues Group at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, on the importance of public service in the 21st century.
I firmly believe, and I've said this very often, that this is the most exciting time in at least a generation to be involved in the public service. And it turns on the two things that I mentioned just a moment ago, the long-term fiscal challenges and the governance issues. And the challenges that federal managers face, the decisions that federal decision makers face in the executive branch and in Congress are really unprecedented in the scope that they confront. The need for good information, the need for good managers, the need for good people to help us navigate our way through these enormous challenges that we as a country face in the next 5, 10, 15 years is just enormous. And so it's an exciting time and a very challenging time to be involved in public management. That's the first point that I would make to people. The second point that I would make is that, you know, the importance of service is that it's to show demonstrable results from their work. That's something that people can come into government from and have complete confidence that what they're working on is improving the lives and livelihood of their fellow citizens. And that's a very, very big deal for people. And so it's both kind of the intellectual excitement and the just the opportunity of being part of something big, as well as the opportunity to return something to our fellow citizens, I think are two very important reasons to be involved in the public service.
Making a difference can take many forms in public service. At first glance, it may also involve many small steps, but wonderful opportunities to lead. Here's Dave Winogrand, Assistant Chief Management Officer at DOD.
I think there's something very noble about this call to public service. And I would offer to, you know, the young people that are thinking about what they want to do with their lives, that it's a chance to make a big difference. I mean, you know, I think across the government, there's opportunities to make a big difference. If I can be parochial for a minute, I would say in the Department of Defense, you know, there are leadership opportunities that you get if you join the military, if you become a government civil servant, that, you know, you might not get in other career fields. Leadership at a younger age, the ability to run things and manage and make a difference. And so, again, back to this idea about, you know, the workforce of our future, the net generation workforce. I mean, they are our prime demographic. 18-year-olds coming out of high school to join the military, 21, 22-year-olds coming out of college to join the military, or come to work as government civilians, or come to work for our industry partners, which are all part of the total force, right? I mean, if we can give them the tools that they need, if we can give them the work kind of environment that they need, if we can change the way we do supervision so it's not about once a year doing a performance appraisal, but it's more about mentoring and giving leadership opportunities and coaching, then wow. So I would say to you, I guess, if you're thinking about careers of public service, there are certain skills that you want to have. I mean, there are certain basic skills that no matter what kind of job you end up with are very helpful to you. You know, how does money work? Because understanding financial management is understanding the lifeblood of any organization, public or private. So financial management, understanding program management, how do you run projects, understanding how the personnel system works. There's sort of all sort of level, you know, sort of entry points about doing it. Stay abreast of technology because today everyone is a technologist. There's almost no job that isn't touched by technology. But really importantly, understand the place that you want to work and its mission. Be able to talk the language of the mission of the organization. Be able to talk about how what needs to be done will help improve that mission, or else you're sort of talking in a vacuum and people only listen to you a little bit. I would say to you, come on board. Make a difference. There's huge opportunities out there.
According to Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration, your fate's largely in your control, but don't overplan.
When I was in college, most of my classmates had career plans, and I set out sort of simplistically just to have an interesting and valuable life and just not worry about where it took me. I think the most important thing is to don't overplan and just go out and do what you believe in. And do what seems valuable. You know, I've had to reinvent myself a number of times, both in the public sector and the private sector. And I think that it's given me opportunities I've never dreamed possible. So when I talk to our leadership classes, one of the things I tend to hit hard on is that, you know, your fate's largely within your control. If you keep investing in yourself, keep trying new things, keep challenging new things, make sacrifices for the organization earlier in your career, and show that you can do different things, you're just more likely to be there and be the person that has to answer the call.
Answering the call matters, and public service can take many different forms. Craig Fugate, FEMA administrator, understands this well and admonishes us to
never pass up the opportunity to volunteer, whether it's in a local response organization like Red Cross or your local county response agencies or city response agencies. The best teaching you'll ever get is the opportunity to serve in a disaster or to participate in exercises to get that experience of what things are like that are not always easily conveyed in a classroom setting. But if you're going to do this, recognize it's not about you being in charge. It's not about you having a lot of power, and it's not about you getting a lot of credit. If things work well, somebody else will be getting the credit, which is good. The team will get recognized, which is good. However, if you fail, you will get a lot of attention. You will live with the consequences of it, and it's not for the faint-hearted. But in those few cases where you make a difference, it's worth everything. Same thing in disasters. We spend bulk of our time working and building teams, struggling through the bureaucracy and battles of budget and authorities and building and practicing and for something that, for most emergency managers, may be a once-in-a-lifetime event. But if it works well, don't expect to be the hero.
There are many opportunities in public service, more than you might think. Scientist, teacher, and former Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy, Dr. Raymond Orbach brings this point home.
I've had quite a long history in academia. I did my research work at Oxford as a postdoc, and then I came to Harvard as an assistant professor. It's been a few years there, and then the lure of California, where I come from, was very great, and I joined the faculty at UCLA. There, I filled a number of scientific and also administrative positions, and after 20 years was appointed as the first provost of the College of Letters and Science at UCLA. It's a large institution, so I grew up learning about administration in real time as I grappled with curriculum and students and their needs during that decade. I was then asked to become chancellor of the University of California, Riverside, where I spent the next 10 years. So my experience in the University of California has lasted almost 40 years. Well, 40 years is a long time to be with a single institution, and so I retired in the beginning of 2002. And simultaneous with that, President Bush invited me to serve as the director of the Office of Science. If you think about art and you think about a painting, you're taught that your eye automatically gravitates to the upper right-hand corner. And so the artist then puts together his painting, his tableau, in such a way that your eye is drawn to that corner. If it's not, you're troubled, and the artist can trouble you by coming up with a painting that makes you feel uneasy. Scientists do the same thing. Scientific discovery is not some set of equations that we know and we write down and we solve and eureka. Scientific discovery is coming up with something completely new. Quite often when we discover things, they're so complex and so cumbersome that we wonder whether they really are true or not. And scientists have a tendency to think that they have finally gotten the answer when it's beautiful, when it's simple, when suddenly they see that all of that complexity can be bottled up in a relatively simple expression or simple structure. It's that aesthetic feeling of simplicity that drives discovery and makes one feel that you have created something. I often say to young people, how many fields in the world can you work in that you have a discovery that is yours, that no one can take away from you? You're the one that figured it out, and everybody else who comes along after knows that. That is so exciting. It's also terribly difficult. More often than not, it's very frustrating where you keep going down wrong paths, and you know they're wrong because in order to explain it, it's too complex. There's something wrong out there. So it's that aesthetic sense of simplicity that I think is behind scientific discovery and which keeps us going, just as exactly as an artist does when they describe their tableau. I view public service as a payback. My own career has been very generously supported by people through their taxes and by our federal government. I view the opportunity of coming to Washington and doing the best job I can as a way of expressing my thanks to this country for the wonderful opportunities it has given me. I would advise young people to get into discovery. It doesn't matter if it's the physical sciences, the mathematics, biological sciences, the science of discovery. It is so exciting, and it has with it a rigor and a process that they will find invaluable in other fields. I would then ask them, over time, to think about payback, about giving this marvelous country of ours a return on its investment in us. That's the way I view federal service, state service, teaching, local service. Each of us expresses our thanks for the support our country has given us through these vehicles.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, recognizes the need to give back, but he also offers wonderful advice when going into public service.
Bring your intellect, bring your passion. Don't be dissuaded by, again, challenges, because it's when you meet those challenges that you learn the most about yourself and you grow the most. Be ready to operate in that gray zone. That's where all the fun is, okay? If you knew and could predict the outcome of your efforts, that would be no fun at all. But it's about taking on these challenges and then creating enduring systems that benefit society far into the future. So public service is, I think, great. It's important. And, you know, and I'm a subscriber to sort of the Jeffersonian approach to sort of public service, which is you come from private, you publicly serve, and then you go back, because then you don't get stale and you renew yourself, and then you come back for another, you know, set of duties if they become available to you.
Raphael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, explains why public service combines the best of all worlds. How can anyone pass up an opportunity both to serve their country and practice their craft? Boris explains.
It's the best career. People come into the public service for all kinds of different reasons. A lot of people ask me, why did I come back into public service? And I really answer it by, how could I not? How could I pass up an opportunity both to serve my country, to practice my craft, to do it in a place that arguably, to me anyway, has the most important mission of all the civilian agencies in the federal government? It's almost like a calling. It's so important. There are trade-offs between going into either the nonprofit, the for-profit, or the public sector. But I think it starts with wanting to do it. You know, I'm here because I want to do it. So I say to the young people,